Hello everyone, welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm Ashley Smith. Today we welcome an expert in prenatal and childhood nutrition, Dr. Nicole Avena. She will teach us ways to recognize and reduce sugar in our diets, and she'll offer research on the addictive properties of sugar. She'll also articulate the importance of eating well during pregnancy, followed by what we can do to start our babies and children off with healthy diets. Sugar is addictive, and we as a society certainly eat too much of it. And Dr. Nicole is here to help us discover ways to reduce sugar intake, and she'll tell us how to eat healthy as a family, despite exposure to sugary foods early in life. Let me tell you just a bit more about our guest. Dr. Nicole Avena is a research neuroscientist and expert in the fields of nutrition, diet, and addiction. Dr. Avena has written the books, Why Diets Fail, What to Eat When You're Pregnant, and What to Feed Your Baby and Toddler. Dr. Avena is a sought-after speaker, and she regularly appears on the Dr. Oz Show. She has also been a guest on several radio programs and podcasts, and has been filmed for several documentaries on the obesity epidemic. She has a TED-Ed talk, How Sugar Affects Your Brain, as well as a blog on Psychology Today called Food Junkie. This episode of CHTV is brought to you by Fast Tonic. This oral stable molecular hydrogen supplement assists in fasting, shows promise in anti-aging, encourages post-workout recovery, mitigates oxidative stress, inflammation, and many other triggers for disease and imbalance. Curious to try molecular hydrogen for yourself? Our CHTV audience can check it out at getfasttonic.com. All right, let's get started and welcome Dr. Pompa and Dr. Nicole Avena to the show. This is Cellular Healing TV.
Dr. Nicole Avena, welcome to Cellular Healing TV.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great. We actually had you on Health Hunters Radio and our radio show, and I love the topic, so I wanted to have you here as well. You know, when we look at addictions today, I mean, come on, there's so many. I think most people are familiar with, you know, of course, drug addiction, alcohol addiction. They understand the severity of it, but sugar addiction. I mean, this is your expert. You've written expertise. You've written three books really dealing with the subject. I mean, even from what to eat during your pregnancy, because what you eat during your pregnancy has a lot to do with addictions in the child later. And then even what to feed your babies and toddlers, that was your other book, because again, that leads to addiction. And then obviously Breaking Addiction. What was that, your first book was Breaking Addiction?
It's called Why Diets Fail.
Why Diets Fail. So, and all those books, folks, you can find on Amazon, I'm sure. And after interviewing her, I can tell you, you might want to pick some of those up, because sugar addiction, let's get into it. Look, I think, you know, I said it, everyone's familiar with alcohol, drug addiction, but I don't know. I mean, more people are probably sugar addicts than anything, and it's a real problem, and it's a problem in the brain. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think you're right, though, that, you know, people, I think, generally recognize that drugs like alcohol and morphine and cocaine, they're addictive. They can be addictive, and people avoid them because they're afraid of getting addicted to them in some cases. But I don't think that the general public has really kind of gotten on board with the idea that sugar can be addictive. Yeah. I think a lot of people experience sugar addiction, but, you know, when you look at our modern food environment, I mean, there's just sugar in so many of the things that we eat, and it's generally recognized as a safe substance. It's a, you know, ingredient in like most of the grocery store items, at least prepackaged ones that you could find when you go grocery shopping. So I think that there's a lot of research that's now been supporting this idea that, you know, this could be a real thing. This is a real problem. And like you were saying, a lot of that comes from the studies that show how it affects the brain. In many ways, it's much like what happens with a drug.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, you have a background in psychology. You have a background, obviously, in neuroscience. So obviously, you get what's going on here and here. And I believe this is a combination of both. I mean, with the background that you have, I mean, you have extensive study. How did you get into this one niche?
Yeah, great question. It kind of just happened. I was doing my PhD at Princeton University, and I was working with my advisor trying to come up with, you know, what project I was going to do for my dissertation work. And we started talking about different ideas. I had been interested in behavior and motivated behaviors, why people do and don't do things. And obesity had come up as something that was particularly interesting because we were starting to see this rise in the obesity epidemic, and there was a lot of media attention being given to that. And it was curious to me because we have all these diet programs, all this advice, all this information out there to help us to eat healthy, but people just can't do it. People have such a hard time giving up the sweets, giving up the junk food, essentially. And so we started thinking about, well, maybe it's like a drug. Maybe some of the foods that people tend to eat, you know, like ice cream, for instance. I mean, there's no ice cream tree. It's not a natural thing. It's a concoction of a bunch of different ingredients and sugars that are designed to make us like it and make us eat it. So what if some of these designer foods are more like drugs than anything? And so we started off doing a series of experiments to try to understand whether or not sugar could be addictive. And almost 15 years later, I'm still doing the same studies. We're still trying to learn more and more about this.
Yeah, so I mean, we know that drugs or any addiction stimulates dopamine, right? I mean, even pulling a slot machine lever, you get a dopamine spike and literally, you know, there you go. You just want that quick fix. Look, I've read recent articles that people that just, you know, it's an email, it's a text, it's Facebook. They're saying it's dopamine spikes, right? And it wants you to just go back and all of a sudden you're addicted. I mean, how is sugar doing that? I mean, how is sugar? So kind of explain the difference with drugs, what I just described, and sugar. Is it all doing the same thing in the brain?
Yeah, it has to do with the degree to which it's doing it. So you're right that, you know, pulling on a slot machine handle or pressing the button or whatever they have on those machines anymore, or, you know, using drugs, doing all these activities, even healthy things like running, for instance, they're reinforcing, and that can release dopamine in reward-related brain regions.
Yes.
Food also releases dopamine. But one of the things that's unique about food and about many of these other behaviors that we don't always get addicted to is that the dopamine release tends to habituate over time. So if you were to eat a new food that you've never tasted before, of course your dopamine is gonna rise when you taste it because it's more associated with the novelty of the food than anything. But once your body has coded it as safe, meaning you know you didn't get sick from it, your brain doesn't release dopamine every time you eat food. It only really releases it when the food is new. Drugs of abuse are different though, because every time you use a drug of abuse like alcohol or cocaine or morphine or nicotine, that releases dopamine in the reward-related brain regions. So that's the big difference between foods and drugs. What our studies have shown and what others have confirmed is that when you overeat sugar, it releases dopamine in a way that looks more like a drug than food. So it's not like, you know, just the first time you have sugar, it's releasing dopamine. When you're overusing sugar, over-consuming it, in excess, it can release dopamine repeatedly. And that's where this whole addiction cascade comes into play, because that release of dopamine causes a whole series of events to occur that change the receptors, change the gene expression. All these other pathways are all connected in the brain, and that's really where it begins.
So, I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, with alcoholism or, you know, drugs, we've discovered, I think, that there is a genetic component of some people are way more predisposed to this. Is it the same with sugar? Or are there some people just like, hey, if they do too much sugar, they're going to be hooked, and some people not?
Yeah. That's a great question. There's actually, there is some evidence that there's a genetic predisposition toward food addiction. And it actually turns out to be the same different alleles of the genes that are also associated with a predisposition to use drugs or to use alcohol. And so there's certainly overlaps between the two. There's also some really interesting research that's looked at the overlap between alcohol use and sugar use and the hereditary component of that. And so there's some data that suggests that, you know, having a mother or a father who might have been an alcoholic or had a problem with alcohol predisposes some people to then maybe become addicted to sugar or to have issues overeating sugar, and vice versa. People who are diagnosed as being alcoholics, there's data that suggests that, you know, when they go back and sort of retrospectively think about what their parents were like when they were younger, there's often the case that the parents, one or more of the parents, was identified as being, you know, someone with a sweet tooth or, you know, really, really liking sugar. So there's certainly an overlap between the two. But I think it's not just genetics, because, you know, our environment is a big part of it. And our you know, our food environment is really, I think, you know, the thing that we have a hard time changing. I mean, we can't change our genetics, obviously, but, you know, we can kind of fight against them with our behavior. Our food environment's a lot different, because, you know, you might want to cut back on sugar, but if you don't even know where your sugar's coming from, like you don't know that the sugar's in maybe a coffee creamer that you use when you were at the coffee shop, then how are you going to cut it out of your diet, or how are you going to reduce it? It's in so many places. It's hidden in really so many places.
Yeah, no, right. The alcoholic, they don't go to the bar, right? And hey, right. I don't eat the alcohol, but it's not hidden in every food like sugar, which makes this, you know, obviously more difficult. And, you know, you referred to the gene. I mean, I agree. I mean, epigenetics is what we realized is most of this, meaning you have a gene of susceptibility and it gets triggered. So, I mean, part of what you talk about, and one of the reasons you wrote the books on what to eat during your pregnancy, and even with the feed, you know, your baby and toddler later, is because you state that a lot of the addiction happens then in utero. Is that epigenetic? You know, does mom trigger the gene in the baby, or is it simply physiological?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. So I got interested in the genesis of sugar addiction. So for many years, we were studying, you know, like trying to establish whether or not sugar addiction was a real thing, whether it was, you know, something we could experimentally see in the lab. And then, that kind of has been continuing to grow, and that literature, I think, has been pretty well established now. It became more apparent to me that we need to try to understand, well, where does this start? Like, you know, it's one thing to know that people are addicted to sugar, but then we're left treating them. How do we prevent it from happening in the first place?
Right.
And so we've been doing a lot of research looking at the effect of diet during pregnancy. And there is this literature that suggests that the first 1,000 days of life, the time period from conception through age 2, is really a critical window for nutritional intervention, meaning that food preferences can be entrained early in that space. It has an effect on immune response later in life. Exposures to various different things during that critical window can have long-term health outcomes. And so I got interested in looking at the effects of overeating sugar during pregnancy and how that might affect the offspring. And we've done several studies that looked at this and found that when, in our laboratory animal studies, when the mother is exposed to sugar, excessive amounts of sugar, it actually produces change in the babies, where they're overweight when they get older, they have a preference for a high fat diet, and they're also having increased triglyceride levels, which is really kind of interesting when you think about it, because they've never even had sugar in their life. They just were simply exposed to it in the womb. So clearly there's a lot that goes on developmentally, and there's so much sensitivity during those critical windows, especially during pregnancy. And we don't really pay much attention to diet during pregnancy. I mean, a lot of the advice that women are given, and I could speak, you know, from personal experience, having had 2 babies of my own, it's just all about body weight. Don't eat this. Don't eat fish because it has mercury in it. Don't eat hot dogs. You know, it's all about not gaining too much weight and avoiding toxins. There's really not a lot of support or guidance for women about, you know, what foods are going to promote a healthy pregnancy, you know, why you should maybe cut back on, you know, carbohydrates and processed sugars, especially if you're having cravings a lot. So that's what inspired me to write What to Eat When You're Pregnant.
Yeah, you know, and I think if women knew that, hold on, eating sugar during my pregnancy could cause this later in my child, I think that they would really say, well, what do I eat then? And that was what your book, the basis of your book was. I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, but, you know, it's interesting because I think about the Duke University study that they took identical twin mice and they exposed one to a toxin and this group to a toxin, this group not. They had the same DNA. And this group became obese. But the next generation, in next generation, became obese, eating the exact same diet as the group over here that remained skinny, meaning they triggered a gene into the next generation. So sugar, obviously, from what your study is showing, does the same thing. Later in life, they become obese. Later in life, they become... high triglycerides, you know, it affects their blood chemistry. You know, so we're seeing that sugar, in fact, is doing the exact same thing. So let's talk about what women eat, because, you know, this is a big deal. We can change generations. So I think the advice is, okay, eat more fruits and vegetables, but nobody does it. And, you know, is that the advice, and or is it more than that?
Well, I think that especially during pregnancy, it's really more about having a healthy diet that has a lot of variety in it so that you're able to get all the essential macronutrients that you need, but also the micronutrients. And especially in the first trimester, it can be tough to do that if people are nauseous or just not feeling well. It can be hard, you know, to eat things that are good for us, like eggs, for instance, which contain, you know, lots of things that would be beneficial, especially for brain development. So I think that it boils down to, you know, helping women during pregnancy and helping new parents too when they begin feeding their baby to really just understand, you know, what are some ideas? What are some healthy things that I can eat at given points? Because you got to keep in mind, you know, during the 9 months of pregnancy, the nutritional needs are not the same on day one as they are on, you know, the last day before you give birth. There's lots of differences in terms of, you know, what micronutrients are needed. And I think that that kind of information can be helpful. And it can also be helpful for women to just understand that, you know, it's not a period of life where, you know, oh, you're gaining weight, so you might as well just give in and, you know, eat it whatever you want, which is not what many people have. It's really about what these foods and exposure to these foods can do to the baby long term. And I think that that's what not a lot of people are aware of. And that's what I'm hoping to bring, you know, more visibility to.
Yeah. So in your book, I mean, we don't have to get into it because your book has, it has what to eat when, because your point is well taken. I mean, there's certain demands and needs for different foods at different times. Where I would say people are going to fail is they don't have a plan. You offer a plan, right? Meaning that, look, they have all, mothers have good intentions until, you know, I think it was Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. So it's like everybody has a plan until they show up to work without their food. I mean, that would be the analogy I'd make. So do you give them a plan?
Yeah, so in what to eat when you're pregnant, I do give a plan that really breaks the pregnancy down week by week. And so what happens is each week, there is a different food of the week that is rich in certain nutrients that are good to be getting that given week. So for instance, early in the pregnancy, the food of the week in one of the weeks in the first trimester would be like spinach, because spinach is really high in folic acid. And so I talk a lot about ways in which you can get more spinach in your diet. It doesn't have to be, you know, sauteed spinach. You can have, throw it in a little bit of a salad. It also includes some recipes. It's really just about giving people ideas so that they understand what nutrients are important to be getting at specific time points so that then they can implement them. And then also so that they can be prepared. And so if you have ideas on what food you should be eating, then when you go grocery shopping, you can, you know, load up on those and then, you know, prepare food so you don't have to get into a situation where you're making a unhealthy food choice because you didn't have snack. So my advice is to really always be prepared, always have something to eat on you, especially if you're pregnant, because you never know when you're going to suddenly just feel like, you know what, I'm hungry. I mean, I think pregnancy is the time when people go from zero to hungry in 2 seconds flat. And it has to do with hormonal fluctuations. It has to just do with the taxing that the baby's taking on our body. But it can lead to poor food choices if you're not prepared. So having a bunch of healthy snacks on hand at all times is really critical.
When you make decisions in emotion, and when you're hungry like that, it's emotion. They're always bad decisions.
Yeah, it's never good.
It's never good. It's like when you make decisions when you're not hungry, you're going to make them from a point of logic. Like, I need to eat good. I'm pregnant. So
Exactly.
So let's move into the babies and the toddlers. I mean, babies, you know, nursing. I mean, that's the number one. And then we start to introduce foods, and then we want to introduce foods because your point is so well taken. I mean, you see kids that ate well as children, you know, even if they as teenagers go back or go out in the world, all of my kids came back. You know, they all went out as teenagers and started eating things, and then they all came back to the diet that they grew up on. So, you know, there's proof right there, and I have 5 kids. So we'll talk about my youngest one in a minute. But yeah, so talk about that, you know, the importance of feeding the kids right.
Yeah, so I wrote a follow-up book to What to Eat When You're Pregnant that actually just came out about a month ago. It's called What to Feed Your Baby and Toddler, because this is really, you know, the next step, right? As we talk about the importance of good nutrition during pregnancy, but we know from that research that the window is really the first 1,000 days. So that goes through age two. And there's a lot of, I think, questions about what you should feed a baby and when. And there's lots of conflicting advice. You know, there's lots of different, you know, arguments out there, depending on who you ask. Some people advocate, you know, you could start a baby at 4 months on solids. Most people, I fall into this camp as well, will suggest waiting till 6 months. But it really comes down to helping parents to understand the importance of basically training the baby to like healthy foods, because you can do it. It's just that people are usually quick to rush to try a whole bunch of different foods because they're excited that the baby's eating and they want to, you know, let them have exposure to all these different things. But if you can get the baby eating lots of vegetables early on, it can really help, because then they're going to develop a taste preference for vegetables and they're not going to balk at them in a couple of months when they're deciding that, you know, they do or do not want to eat something.
So the brain is developing those things. That's why it happens, right? I mean, the brain is literally developing. So as you're giving them those flavors, the brain is liking them.
Right. And the brain's encoding, you know, that they're safe and that they're nutritious. But part of the problem that we face in the baby food world is that if you look at the commercially available baby foods, a lot of them are blends. And a lot of them are things that contain a lot of fruit. And it's often the case that the fruit is masking the taste of any vegetable that's in the fruit. And so, you know, my favorite example is around Thanksgiving time, a lot of the companies who manufacture baby food will put out a turkey dinner, right? So it's supposed to be the equivalent of, like, you know, our turkey dinner, our Thanksgiving dinner. And it is promoted to be, you know, a turkey. It's going to have turkey in it. It's going to have maybe some cranberries, a little bit of apples and vegetables. But when you look at the actual ingredients and the amount that's in there, there's hardly any turkey in there. It's mostly apples. Yeah. It's mostly apples. And that happens with a lot of different blends. And so what happens is, I think we start our babies off liking sweet, and they naturally are going to like sweet. They're born liking sweet. It's innate. They're going to like it no matter what. And what happens is, of course, if they taste something sweet like an apple, then of course the peas aren't going to taste that good, right? Because they don't taste an apple. So I think that, you know, many parents fall into this trap of, you know, wanting to please the baby and make them happy, and they end up giving them too much fruit, in my opinion. And so I advise that people try to stick to giving vegetables by themselves without the fruits blended in. And if anything, chase it at the end with a little bit of fruit as, like, the dessert.
Yeah, I could not agree more. Let's take it one step worse. Fruit juice, you know, that satisfies them, right? And then there they are. It's basically a cup of sugar, but because it's 100% orange juice, moms think it's okay, or dads as well. But the fact is it's just pure sugar.
Right. The American Academy of Pediatrics, I guess about a year or so ago, came out with guidelines stating that there is no place for fruit juice in a child under the age of one. I think there's no place for fruit juice in any child or adult, for that matter. Yeah. But yeah, you know, when you give your kid fruit juice, it really is just sugar water. You're sucking all the fiber, all the nutrients out of the fruit, and you're just giving them the sugar. And so I often suggest to people, if you really want your kid to have, like, a fruit juice type of beverage, blend up a whole fruit, make a smoothie for them, so that at least they're still going to get the fiber, they're going to get the other nutrients in the fruit. And, you know, it's not going to be just this bolus of sugar, because that's essentially what it is when you're having fruit juice.
Yeah. Well, look, yeah, we're starting into the solution of the problem, and you can see it starts in utero, and then it starts what we're feeding our children, right? I mean, obviously, the more vegetables mom eats, the more vegetables the baby's going to like. And as children, the more vegetables we give them, the more they'll like later. And we're beating the sugar addiction here. All right, let's step back. Because we've created a world full of addicts at this point, some worse than others, let's face it. And we already talked that could be genetic. But what do we do? I mean, we talked about, you know, the alcoholic. I mean, we can just say, hey, just stay away from the alcohol. But as we mentioned, sugar's in everything, right? So, yeah. I mean, what do we do about this? I mean, do we cold turkey? Do we wean them down? What have you found in your studies to be the best?
Yeah, I think much like with drug treatment for drug addictions, it's not always going to be that one approach is going to work for everybody. And so I think that, you know, there has to be multiple ways to treat this. And when people try one thing, if it doesn't work, they might have to move on to the next. Some people advocate a cold turkey approach, just like you would use with drugs or alcohol. I personally think that that is very, very difficult to do in our modern food environment because, you know, we're constantly bombarded with food, with sugar. It's everywhere. The advertisements for it are everywhere. That's not the case for drugs and alcohol. You don't ever really see advertisements for alcohol. You never see like billboards with drug paraphernalia on them or anything like that. So people who have drug and alcohol problems are constantly having to fight off these urges from the visual cues in our environment. Whereas people who are trying to cut back on sugar are, it's on a, you know, you walk down the street and you get hit with hundreds of images of food and smells and things like that. So I suggest that, you know, if cold turkey isn't going to work, then I think more of like a harm reduction approach is better. And a harm reduction approach really is exactly what it says. It's reducing the harm that the substance is causing you. And so it's getting to the point where you're back in control of how much of the substance you consume. And so when it comes to something like sugar, I think it really comes down to taking baby steps. And I know this goes in the face of what everybody wants because people want to just, you know, be off the sugar, have it done, out of my life. But if you want something that's sustainable, it's going to have to be something that kind of grows slowly. So I often suggest that people start off by picking the one thing that's the worst for them, that's causing them the most harm as it comes to sugar. And that happens to be sugar-sweetened beverages. Absolutely. So if you're a soda drinker, it's time to ditch the soda. Same with the fruit juice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So in your books, that's step one, right? You know, get rid of all of these sugar drinks, which, by the way, I mean, there's multiple reasons for that. I mean, these drinks, as we pointed out, I mean, they're the biggest culprits. I mean, they're the thing driving the diabetes epidemic and the obesity epidemic. I mean, and again, it's the ones you even think healthier that say 100% orange juice, right? I mean, then you have your vitamin drinks. Then you have your Red Bulls. I mean, these, you know, it gets higher and higher with the levels of sugar, caffeine, even the chemicals that are addictive. Yeah. So now you have a chemical, the sugar. I mean, the most addictive things, all the kids are drinking them. So how do you get rid of them?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, you raised some really good points about like the liquid beverages being the culprit, and they are. And in my book, Why Diets Fail, which is a book that is really all about the science of sugar addiction, all about what the research is telling us, and then ways in which you can reduce sugar in your diet and recognize all the different places that it is. So that's also part of the problem is, you know, people don't know what to look for because when you turn a label over, it doesn't just say sugar. It says brown cane syrup, or it'll say agave, or it'll say all other things. Yeah. There's like 50 different terms that are used that are under that umbrella of sugar. So I think, you know, the thing about the sugar-sweetened beverages is that they're basically calories that you never get full from, right? You know, nobody ever says, oh, I just had a can of soda, I'm full, even though it could be 200 calories or 300 calories. But we should feel some satiety from that amount of calories, but we don't. The liquid calories just do not affect our satiety system in the same way that solid calories do from food. So that's why it's so easy to consume a gallon of soda a day, because you really just never get full off of it. And that's, I think, a big factor that contributes to why people become overweight.
Yeah, and it actually does the opposite. It actually leads to more hunger, you know? And, you know, so, and then it's so high in sugar, it blunts your insulin receptors, your leptin receptors. So then it screws up your feedback that shuts your brain off permanently. So now you have issues with that. All right, what's step two? We get rid of the sugary drinks, step two.
Right, so sugary drinks, and don't forget the sugary drinks also includes fruit juice and also coffee drinks. That's a big one that people don't realize.
The additives to coffee is the killer.
Creamer, and even like soy milk or almond milk, those types of things absolutely work on people.
If you go to a Starbucks and you see what's in those lattes that the world is drinking, it is a nightmare. It is a disaster. I've looked at the ingredients and the sugar is through the roof. That's why it's all part of the addiction. You have the caffeine that's addictive, but the sugar and the chemicals, it's ridiculous. Cut that out.
Yeah, and a lot of those coffee drinks, they're, let's face it, they're desserts. They're not coffee. It's a dessert. If you have whipped cream on top of it, it's a dessert, no matter what you say.
No problem with regular coffee.
Yeah. So the second step, after you've gotten rid of all the sugar-sweetened beverages and the beverages that are high in sugar in your diet, then it comes to identifying what are the trigger foods. So what are the foods that you tend to overeat or the foods that you go to that you feel like you don't have control of? And I don't think people need to, you know, empty out their pantries and, you know, get rid of everything. I think you have to take the foods one at a time. So for instance, if you're like a cookie person and it happens to be cookies, you have to really sit down and evaluate, okay, well, what is it about these cookies that I like? Is it that they're, you know, chewy? Is there something about them? Could I bake cookies or make them in a way that's healthier, that's not going to contain so much sugar? And really just try to understand what it is you like about the food so that you can replace it with something healthier. It's not about depriving yourself. It's about replacing it with a non-sugar alternative. So that's really the next step. And that step can last a while because you really need to then go through each of the foods that, you know, are high in sugar that you're coping with and come up with alternative foods that can satisfy them. And in my book, I have lots of examples about, you know, the typical foods that people tend to overeat that have lots of sugar in them, and then sort of safer foods that aren't going to contain as much added sugar, if any at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. That's a great step. Yeah, you know, and I think the other thing too is that we talked about is, you know, preparation, you know, being prepared, right? I mean, if you end up at work or at the church meeting without one of these things that you switch with, you could be in trouble real fast. I mean, so my yeah. advice would be prepared. I'm sure you discussed that.
I do. And I think preparation is really key. And, you know, the reality is we're busy people, right? Everyone's got a lot going on. And we tend to kind of put our food on the side in the sense that, you know, we know that you can always pop into a store and grab something to eat, right? You know that there's convenience stores everywhere you go. So it's not as much of a priority for people because they know they can get food and it can be pretty cheap to get it if they need to get it. So I think a lot of people really rely on the convenience factor a little bit too much, and it causes us to sometimes make poor food choices. And so I think it's really important to, you know, come up with a plan of snacks or food items that you can have with you if you're on the run, or if you're taking your kids places and stuff like that, that you can make sure you're eating something that's healthy and that you want to eat, so you don't have to make an impulse decision and eat, you know, something out of a convenience store that is going to be loaded with sugar.
Yeah. You know, I totally said my son, Simon, so my five kids, the four older ones, you know, we raised them the right way, the way you're describing. And, you know, as I said, they went off as teenagers. They all came back and they all eat healthy now, you know, all four of them. Now, Simon, he was, you know, when we moved from Pittsburgh to here 6 years ago in Park City, you know, Simon was raised well on a good diet, but we had a lot of stress in our life. We moved and we just took the hands off, which you do with the last child anyway. You know, it's like, you just got to say, he'll figure it out. The other ones did. And, you know, evidently he was going, you know, riding his bike down to the convenience store at the end of the street. You know, he got sugar addicted. So we had one of the five who was sugar addicted. And of course he became, you know, 30 pounds overweight. I mean, the whole thing. And of course the other kids would be like, why do you let him get away with this? We couldn't eat anything. And we were just like, you know, Simon, you know, you got to figure it out. Of course, he didn't want to hear it. And then right. I saw a picture of, I was doing a PowerPoint, and it was, she had severe eczema and psoriasis, really. And he saw the before and the after. And he asked, of course, what she did. And of course, I said she did these dietary changes, everything I teach, my cellular detox, and she fasted. So he left the room and came back and said, I'm going to fast. And of course, I didn't think he was going to. He made it the next day. Or he made it through that day, with which I was amazed. The next day, he did another day. So, you know, bottom line is he went 11 days, okay, on a fast. And it actually ended up fixing his addiction, literally. I mean, it just, after that, he started eating more vegetables and he started just doing better and all the weight came off. But and to this day, that was a couple of years ago. To this day, he's lean and mean. But, you know, it really was the thing of him seeing the picture of the woman. I mean, that must be something that is a driver for this, because if you just say, I want to lose weight. If I, you know, I'm going to get rid of the sugar. I don't know if that's enough. It seems like it takes the hard thing. Am I right on that?
I think you're right. And I think, you know, part of the issue is that people don't take their health seriously until there's something wrong with their health.
Right.
And it takes a wake up call for, you know, because I think people generally tend to just assume that they're well and, you know, oh, maybe they're a little bit overweight, but hey, you know what? Everybody's a little overweight, so it's not a big deal.
That's it. Yeah.
And, you know, that can be okay. But I think that, you know, what happens is because obesity is a chronic condition, meaning, you know, you're not going to drop dead after because you ate one cupcake, but over the course of many years, the long-term effects of overeating and carrying that extra body weight can increase your risk for diseases. And so it's really like a chronic condition, and it's a slow killer, essentially. And, you know, so that's why it's not like, you know, something that I think really resonates with people until they have a problem, until something physically happens to them, until they get told, oh, you have diabetes, or, you know, oh, you have high blood pressure, now you need to be on a statin. It's one of those things where they need to kind of hear something happen before they take it seriously.
You know, I mean, people get on the statin and they think, hey, the drug fixes it, I'm fine. Or they get on the diabetic medication.
Right.
Time and a place for medication. However, they don't realize that people that take the medication die at the same rate that the people who don't. So, I mean, when you look at the stats, it's like, okay, because you didn't get rid of the cause. So I think right. It's even a false protection, even then.
It is. And I think it's always better, you know, if we can have food be our first line of defense in terms of preventing diseases and, you know, use nutrition to our benefit, I think that's really key. And so I think that I'm hoping we'll start to see a change in the way in which people think about their health and especially the role of diet in our health. Because right now, I don't think that, you know, there's really much seriousness taken about how your diet can affect your health long term. And it's certainly among little kids, we don't see that happening as well. Most little kids, and I have two little kids of my own, so I can speak from personal experience too. You know, the mindset is really about, you know, having fun, and, you know, the health is not taken all that seriously, and nutrition especially.
You know, some years ago marketed, it's not your fault. You know, really talking a lot about what we're talking about. So your first book was called Why Diets Fail. So I think we answered the question, but in simply put, why do diets fail?
Diets fail because of the way we think about the term diet. Everybody wants to go on a diet and then go off the diet once they lose weight, but that's not how it's going to work. Diets fail because people have this mindset that it's a temporary thing. You're going to do this for a few months or a year, and then you're going to, you know, go back to eating your old ways. And if you really want to make long-term changes in your health and your weight, the diet has to be the way you eat for the rest of your life. It's not a quick fix. It's not something you're going to do temporarily. It has to be a big change. The other reason why diets fail is because our diets are loaded with added sugars. And with all this research that's supporting this idea that they could be addictive, you know, it's really hard to beat something when it's an addiction, especially when we haven't admitted it's an addiction. And, you know, just like one of the first steps when someone, you know, becomes an alcoholic or wants to seek out treatment for an addiction to drugs, they have to admit that they have an addiction, right? That's it. But, you know, as a society, if we're not admitting that sugar is addictive, then how are we going to ever get off of it or reduce how much we're consuming of it?
Yeah, I think that's the importance of your research, your books, and your work. What about the artificial sweeteners? I mean, I've read that some of them are more addictive even than sugar. And of course, they're showing up in many of the foods.
Right. Artificial sweeteners are an interesting case because, you know, in terms of the addiction, it has more to do with the sweet taste than it does the actual type of sweetener. And so studies show that the artificial sweeteners can still activate the dopamine system and that reward system in the brain, much like what happens with regular sugar. You might save calories, but there's also studies that suggest that you're going to eat more calories later on if you consume something with artificial sweetener compared to a regular, you know, caloric sweetener. I think we're starting to see a lot more artificial sweeteners and sugar alcohols in our food supply, and that's because there's new regulations in place that companies need to disclose the amount of added sugar in food products. and artificial sweeteners aren't added sugar. So you can have artificial sweeteners in, you know, a box of cookies and also have regular sugar, but they only have to report how much regular sugar they put in. So they might want to make it taste extra sweet. So they're going to add some artificial sweeteners to do the job too, because that way they don't have to say on the box that, oh, this is 200% of your daily recommended value of added sugar, because no one wants to see that on the back of a menu label. So I think that's really, you know, something we're going to start to hear more and more about as more companies are having to change their formulations of these different foods to address the fact that, you know, we're going to have more artificial sweeteners in our diet just because of these new regulations.
And draw a distinction for our viewers and listeners, because it's very confusing when you look at a label, as you pointed out, right? But I mean, you know, we can look at the total carbohydrates, and then there's sugar, there's fiber, and there's, you know, different parts that make up that total, right? So that's confusing. Right. And there's a difference when you get natural sugar from a sweet potato versus, as we were saying, just the straight sugar in the drink. So kind of right. Try to clarify some of that for people, because I know people are confused on it, and that's what leads to their failure oftentimes.
Right. So when you're looking at, for instance, you know, if you buy like a really good applesauce, let's say, it doesn't have added sugar in it, it's just really pureed apples, you would look on there and you would see how many carbohydrates it contains, and that number might be relatively high. And then you'd see that it contains, let's say, 9 grams of sugar. Now, that sugar is all coming naturally from the apples. It's not added sugar, okay? There's a new regulation that now requires on the nutrition facts label, and you'll probably see this on lots of products if you haven't already, and that line under sugars is added sugars. And this is where it's the added sugar. So when you're looking at labels, that's the one you want to pay careful attention to, because you can have, like I said, pureed apples, or, you know, something that happens like sweet potato puree, something like that's going to naturally be high in sugars, and that might be fine. But the added sugar is what you need to watch out for. So you want to take a look at that and hopefully see that to be as low as possible. But like I said, keep in mind that, you know, the companies are clever, and there's going to be some, you know, changes. You're going to start to see a lot more sugar alcohols added to these different products to make up the, for the sweetness that they can't get by adding all that sugar in that they typically would.
Right. Now, I mean, in an alcohol, sugar might not raise blood sugar the same. However, to your point, the sweet still gives the addiction, and those who struggle with the sweet and the addiction, you're not solving your addiction problem.
Right, exactly. I think that's the big point, is that, you know, if you're really looking to cut out sugar, then you have to cut out fake sugar too. And I think that, you know, people use it as a crutch, and that's fine in the beginning, but I think, you know, eventually the goal should be to try to just get rid of the excess amount of sweetener in your diet, whether it's, you know, stevia or a sugar alcohol or something. It really is about reducing the amount of sweet that we're exposed to, because that's what's activating these brain systems and causing us to want to overeat it continually.
So, I mean, I guess the hope is, I mean, obviously in your book, you describe this process of weaning down. You know, I mean, it could be done, right? Because I think that's the worry, is like, okay, am I the alcoholic that can't just ever have one drink and I'm doomed? It worked, you know, I mean, with sugar, it works a little different than that. And in fact, you can wean down and get your brain to not desire as much, correct?
Yeah, that's really the goal, is to get to the point where you're back in control, where you feel like, you know, I can have one or two cookies and I'm not going to have to eat the whole bag. So it might mean that for a couple of weeks or months, you don't have any cookies and you're, you know, eating something that's a replacement for that, those cookies, or for whatever the food is that you're trying to avoid. But the goal is to get to the point where you can, you know, enjoy these things, but in moderation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that takes a lot of self-monitoring, because, you know, when, you know, and a lot of people will ask me, like, well, when will I be there? And when can I have this again? And I can't answer that. It's really about you and about, you know, what's happening in your physiology and, you know, where you are and where you feel that you can be in control. And I think that is a very individual thing. So it involves a lot of, you know, kind of stepping back and taking a look at yourself and saying, hey, you know, if I go for this little piece of cake, am I going to be satisfied with that? Or am I going to feel like I need to have another and another? And that's when you have to ask yourself those tough questions and be able to give yourself those tough answers if necessary.
Well, you know, I think one of the things you pointed out is you can't, your brain can't ever feel like it's deprived. If it feels deprived, you're going to break. You're going to break at the next emotional thing or whatever it is, right? I mean, so you have to, and that's going to be a little different for everybody, right? I mean, what makes you feel not deprived? So you have to figure out, you know, what is going to make me not feel deprived, because then it can be a complete lifestyle, right? So one of the things when I interviewed on the radio show, I talked about how we have my diet variation concept and we throw in one or two feast days a week. And I was surprised that people said, you know, that's the thing that keeps me going, that I could do this forever. And I'm like, huh, you know, because it was, and again, these are feast days. I'm telling them to eat healthy carbohydrates like sweet potatoes and different things, but it becomes the treat for them. And they're like, I can do this forever. So, you know, is that a strategy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's like the whole idea of like, you have something to look forward to, right?
Yeah.
And you're not sucking all the joy out of life. I mean, if you know that, hey, I'll indulge in the thing I want, I just got to wait a couple of days, it's going to happen. And I think that can be a strong motivator for people. And I think that can work on many levels. And, you know, I think the key though is just to make sure that you're in control when you do have those feast days.
Yeah,
and the feast,
otherwise just keep going.
Right. And if the feast day doesn't turn into the feast weekend or the feast week or, you know, those types of things that might happen.
Well, you know, I think that's the importance of making sure there's still no refined added sugars in it, right? Because they're going to be far more addictive than the sweet potato, right? Because the sweet potato has vitamins, fiber, et cetera, which is not going to be the same addiction, so.
Yeah, exactly.
No. Well, and that's a good point, though, because, you know, you can replace some of that desire with really healthy, you know, there's a sweet component, like you said, right? I mean, we're innately driven to some sweet. So, you know, going towards the more fiber, healthy, vitamin rich foods that have the sweet, it's going to be far different than saying, you know what, I'm just going to eat the cake. If you're an addict, don't do that. That you're going to end up in great danger.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, there's lots of things out there that if you have a sweet tooth, you can crave them by eating a date.
Yeah.
If you're having I mean, that's super sweet. And it, you know, but what happens when people get off of the processed foods and stop eating so much of them? I've had so many people come to me and say, oh my goodness, I never realized how sweet strawberries could be or how sweet, you know, blueberries could be, because they never experienced it because their tongues and their brains were so used to being bombarded with added sugar that they weren't able to detect the sweetness in the natural things that have sugar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really, if you start to look at, you know, the information that's out there, a lot of this I have in my book, Why Diets Fail, there's a lot of foods that are out there that are naturally sweet that can satisfy your sweet craving. It doesn't have to come from added sugar. It doesn't have to come, you know, from highly processed foods. It really can come from nature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Avina, do you have a website that people
I do. Yep, I do. It's www.drnicoleavina.com. And there's links to all of our research papers on the site. There's also links to my books and presentations and different events that I'll be attending. So definitely check it out.
Well, I appreciate your research, wealth of knowledge. Thank you for being on Cell TV. And, you know, hey, you'd be even a great addition to one of my seminars as well. So appreciate it. Thank you for coming on. Great information.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, which was brought to you by Fastonic Molecular Hydrogen. Please check it out at getfastonic.com. We'll be back next week and every Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern. We truly appreciate your support. You can always find us at podcast.drpompa.com. And please remember to spread the love by liking, subscribing, giving an iTunes review, and sharing the show with anyone you think may benefit from the information heard here. And as always, thanks for listening.